If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There are several different tiers available with perks to go along with each, including an exclusive monthly series available only on Patreon. Each episode will feature a different individual who has committed murder in the state of Texas. We'll outline their crime or crimes and let the listeners decide if they are responsible for others. We sincerely appreciate all donations as they help cover the costs associated with research and production. Thanks, y'all. We'd also like to ask that you stick around until the end of the episode for a promo of our friend's podcast, Ohio Valley True Crime. Now onto the show.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
As we were getting ready to leave, Carla asked if anybody had something to stir her drink with. She had a mixed drink. So I handed her an ink pen, and she stirred with that. The reason I remember that is because I was excited to meet Carla.
On February 16, 1974, Carla Walker and Rodney McCoy attended the Western Hills High School dance. Benbrook Police Officer Dee Underwood helped chaperone the event. He made sure the teenagers weren't spiking the punch or going back and forth to their cars to sneak draws of booze. Officer Underwood recalled seeing Carla and Rodney that evening.
A couple times a year, they'd have some kind of dance up there, and they'd always hire a couple of the Benbrook police officers to come up and, you know, chaperone the dance. You know, I knew Carla, not personally, really personally, but I mean, I knew her from just being around the school thing. At the time, I was a senior officer, and I was actually a shift supervisor on the night shift. And I remember talking to her and Rodney, and they both seemed like real good kids. And I never heard anything bad said about them. I think Rodney was her quarterback at Western Hills High School. She was just a good all-around kid there, too, you know. So it was a shock when that happened. But I do remember as they were leaving, I said, Rodney, y'all be careful now. You know, you've got a big responsibility taking care of that girl. And he told me, Mr. Underwood, I'm not going to let anything happen, Carla. You know, I think too much of her to let anything happen to her. I said, that's good. You guys be safe. She's a very pretty girl. She dressed really nice that night. Rodney was dressed nice. I remember it pretty well because that's something that kind of stays on your mind, you know.
It was around 11:30 when the dance began to wind down, and Carla and Rodney left with another couple. The other couple climbed in the back seat of Rodney's car, leaving the vehicle they arrived in at the high school. Though many rumors and much speculation have been reported by those who were not there and did not see the two couples together, the events that occurred during this period of the night have never been confirmed to anyone other than law enforcement. I recently spoke with one member of that couple, who helped provide an understanding of the events, but more importantly, the evening's timeline.
I did not know Rodney or Carla. I remember going to the Valentine dance, and when it was getting closer to time for the dance to end, maybe 11:30, Gary asked me if I wanted to hang out with Rodney and Carla. I did not even know that Rodney and Gary were friends. So we went out of the front door of the school and got into Rodney's car. Gary sat on the left passenger. I sat on the right passenger. Rodney was driving. As we were getting ready to leave, Carla asked if anybody had something to stir her drink with. She had a mixed drink. What kind, I don't remember, but they weren't drinking beer. So I handed her an ink pen, and she stirred with that. The reason I remember that is because I was excited to meet Carla. I was not in her social group, and it was interesting to me. That's why it stuck out. The cheerleader asked for something from me. For some reason, I had an ink pen. I remember we smoked pot. I remember Carla went into the bathroom in the bowling alley. She came out. She seemed to be walking okay, but we were all high and drinking. I smoked. I didn't drink, but I know Gary did both. Carla and Rodney were drinking, but I don't know if they smoked that night or not. I don't remember a lot of cars in the parking lot because it was so late. When she came out of the bowling alley, she just walked directly to us, and there was a lot of space for me to see. She wasn't going through cars or around people. I don't recall seeing a person the whole time we were there. About 12:30, I asked Carla, I said, what time is your curfew? And she said, I don't have one. And I said, well, I have a 1 o'clock curfew, so we've got to go back to Gary's car. So Rodney drove us back to the school parking lot. I believe we were parked on the back side of the school. We got in the car and I went on home.
Nothing out of the ordinary occurred during the two couples' time together, to be sure, but an account of what took place certainly helps eliminate several theories and accounts that have come our way. It should be noted that the police did speak with Brenda the morning following Carla's abduction, but not since.
Then the first time I knew something was when the police came to my house about 6 o'clock in the morning, 5:36, somewhere in there. My mother came to wake me up, and I came into the kitchen, and the Benbrook police were there. She said they wanted to ask questions. I was horrified because they were talking about Gary, and I thought he was being busted for drinking or smoking pot. So I was keeping quite tight-lipped about that, but I was very groggy. I hadn't had much sleep. And finally, after answering questions, and they said that there had been an incident with Rodney and Carla had been kidnapped. And then that was the last I ever spoke to the police. They never came back and asked me questions or followed up in any way.
Now the early morning of February 17th, sometime just after 1 a.m., Carla Walker and Rodney McCoy sat kissing in his car in the back parking lot of the Ridgely Brunswick Bowling Alley. Carla was violently stripped from the passenger side of the vehicle after the door was jerked open suddenly from the outside. The strange man that dragged Carla from the car told Rodney, "I'm going to kill you," before bludgeoning him with the butt of a pistol. In a last-ditch effort to free his girlfriend from the madman's grip, Rodney tried exiting the vehicle, but failed in his attempt as the man pointed the weapon inches from Rodney's face and fired 3 times. Rodney fell unconscious, and Carla was taken. After waking, soaked in blood and in a panic, he sought help at the Walker's residence. Rodney was driven by ambulance to Peter Smith Hospital, where he was treated and stitched for multiple gaping wounds to the front and back of his head, as well as a long cut below his right eye before being released. Rodney told officers that when the gun fired, it didn't produce the deafening sound that you would expect from a pistol at that close of a range. He reconciled that it was some sort of pellet gun, but the perpetrator's weapon hadn't actually fired. The only two pieces of physical evidence that police were able to collect from the scene of Carla's abduction were a clip belonging to a .22 caliber Ruger pistol and Carla's purse that laid beside it. The clip had released, slipped out, and fell to the ground during the brutal assault on Rodney. There are firearms, including some Rugers, that have what is called a magazine safety, a feature that prevents the gun from firing when the clip is disengaged, even if a round has been loaded into the chamber. It can probably be assumed, then, that the type of Ruger used in the abduction had this feature. This mistake is either a result of the perpetrator using the pistol to assault Rodney as an unplanned, necessary reaction to Rodney's actions to protect Carla, or a small but significant miscalculation that bludgeoning the young man wouldn't cause the magazine to slip from the firearm. Either way, it is the only reason he survived the night's events. Rodney was able to provide the police with a vague description of the perpetrator, since he only caught a glimpse of the man before he was beaten. The darkness of the night sky was blinding when set against the dim light shining from the car's interior. He described the attacker as white, clean-cut, and wearing a light-colored cowboy hat. The cowboy hat had fallen off the man almost immediately, as he jerked open the door, exposing light brown, close-cropped hair that appeared wavy on top. Rodney said the man talked like a cowboy, which likely means a southern drawl was prevalent. He believed the man was in his early to mid-20s and guessed he was about 5 feet 10 inches tall, weighing somewhere between 165 and 180 pounds. Rodney's recollections were enough to create a composite sketch. The sketch was never released, however, because the police thought it would likely confuse the investigation. The composite was described as too generic, that it could have been virtually anyone. The description of the perpetrator did not change when Rodney was later put under hypnosis, though it was expanded to include a shiny green vest over a long-sleeved shirt. He also described a vehicle he saw as he faded out of consciousness. It was light in color, medium-sized, with only yellow or amber parking lights on. Rodney remembered it as parked in the parking lot's exit lane, facing the street. A light-colored cowboy hat was found later in the day of Carla's abduction, laying in the middle of El Retiro Road, a residential area. It was turned over to police. The hat's location was about 1.2 miles from the scene. No comment on its significance or lack thereof has ever been made. As was the case with evidence on the scene and elsewhere, very few credible witnesses emerged during Carla's abduction. A 29-year-old bowler who wished to remain anonymous reported seeing a car sitting in the exit lane in the back parking lot of the Ridgely Brunswick Bowl in the time frame of the attack. The car was running, with only parking lights on. He described the vehicle as possibly Chevrolet, beige in color, four-door, and as an early 70s model. A Western Hills High School student who also wished to remain anonymous provided us with a potentially important account of what happened earlier in the evening of the 16th. She was bowling with her boyfriend that night, and because of the effect the tragedy had on her life, she remembered details clearly.
The night that it happened, everybody was at a Valentine's dance at school, and I had a date, and like I said, I ran around with a whole different group of kids. There was a hamburger joint just right up the street from the bowling alley. That's where everybody cruised at this hamburger joint and used the restroom and all that. Well, they had kind of shut it down to the cruising thing, so everybody would come to the bowling alley to use their restroom. So the night that it happened, we were all, my boyfriend and two of his friends and I were bowling, and the kids started coming in from the dance, and they all had on their formals and all that, right? So I just remember looking at all their dresses and things. And so the thing that I remember that has always stuck in my head that is so strange, and it later kind of connected somehow, there was a man that was bowling by himself in the furthest lane. And I remember him distinctly because he was bowling by himself, and I remember even what he was wearing. So he was wearing a brown cowboy hat, which was really odd, and then he had on a sleeveless vest, one of the feather, we called them comfy vests. And it was olive green. I remember the thing specifically, and that he was bowling by himself, and he kept watching everybody. That guy is always just stuck in my head. And yeah, he was bowling all by himself, and he was in that in lane. I just will never forget that. And whenever you would walk in from the door that they would walk in from the parking lot, if a guy was bowling in the corner, if he was actually behind a wall, so if they walked in from that street door, they might not have seen him.
She was never questioned by police. After Carla's body was found on February 20th, 1974, police began examining all the information and potential evidence and leads that had piled up from the moment Carla was abducted. Rodney's vehicle, the purse, the Ruger clip were all examined and dusted for prints multiple times. In the end, though, only the clip would provide the evidence they sought in the form of a partial palm print. Because it wasn't standard practice for police agencies at the time to take what is known as a full FBI roll, a procedure the FBI uses so that prints on the entire hand can be matched, it wasn't possible to compare them to individuals who'd already been through the police department's system. Benbrook Mayor Wayne Wilson told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that there were tens of thousands of junior detectives all over the region investigating the case, all eager to bring the perpetrator of this terrible crime to justice. Six homicide detectives from the Fort Worth Police Department were assigned to the investigation. Fort Worth homicide detective George Hudson remarked, Everybody and their brother has seen a man in a cowboy hat and phoned it in. Not much was publicized about the investigation into Carla Walker's murder. More often than not, police were simply quoted as saying that they just had nothing new or some other ambiguous progress report. Little is known still about the Fort Worth Police Department's methods, mainly due to their continued silence on Carla's case, among many other unsolved homicides. However, some light has been shown on the investigation that the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office performed, as well as some insight into potential problems. The investigation was stifled, at least partially due to issues with jurisdiction. Carla was abducted in Fort Worth, but her body was found in Tarrant County. Former acting sheriff and chief deputy Jim Minter was an investigator for the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office at the time of Carla's abduction and murder. According to Minter, there was a massive disconnect between the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office and the Fort Worth Police Department. Fort Worth didn't notify Tarrant County about cases that were similar in nature to Carla's. Minter remembers some specific instances of this. Within weeks of the discovery of Carla's body, Fort Worth police pulled over a vehicle in which a woman was found in the trunk. The man driving the car was immediately considered a person of interest in Carla Walker's murder. However, the arrest of the man wasn't reported to the county. On December 23, 1974, less than a year after Carla's abduction and murder, Rachel Trelisa, 17, Lisa Renee Wilson, 14, and Julianne Mosley, 9, disappeared after a shopping trip to Seminary South Shopping Center in South Fort Worth. This location is around 8 miles from the scene of Carla's abduction. Though there was no evidence, police presumed the three to be victims of foul play eventually. This also neglected to be shared with the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office. Jim Minter investigated Carla's case for 2 years. He insists that the case was worked, quote, hard and honestly by the county, with hundreds upon hundreds of suspects and leads investigated by him alone. The county attempted to run down every model of Ruger pistol sold in the area. Only one Ruger out of a lot of 25 to 30 could not be traced, as it was stolen in a burglary. Minter continues to be affected by the case to this day. It's the hardest case, he said, that he's ever worked. Because the sheriff's office had no official records-keeping system at the time, an investigator assigned to a case kept track of the files associated with it. Minter believes that Tarrant County's files on Carla were most likely thrown away or destroyed. It has been confirmed by the current record keeper that the sheriff's department holds no such files today. During the abduction period of Carla's case, the Walker family began receiving mysterious phone calls. Charlene Walker, Carla's mother, told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that the calls were sporadic and sometimes occurred in the morning, sometimes in the afternoon. Saying hello upon picking up the ringing phone, the greeting would be returned by complete silence. Sometimes Charlene or Carla's father, Layton, would wait minutes to hear something, anything, come from the other end of the line, but nothing ever happened. The calls came every week or sometimes every other week. Carla's sister, Cindy, explained to us that the calls continued for years. In May of 1975, Charlene answered a call in which the caller specifically asked for Dalton. Dalton was the pseudonym of a man who had set up a phone line and offered a reward for tips leading to the conviction of Carla's killer. His reward had expired months prior to this call. Charlene begged the caller for what number he was attempting to dial, but the nervous man abruptly hung up after repeating the digits. One of Carla's closest friends began receiving similar phone calls after giving an interview to the papers. They had printed the teenager's name in the articles. Starting sometime after Carla was buried, and continuing for many years after, the family would visit her final resting place, only to find a single carnation placed in the urn at her grave. The Walkers have always believed that the phone calls and the flowers were connected to the individual who killed Carla. Besides the tip-off to the location of Carla's body, the Fort Worth Police Department received another call. This telephone call happened shortly after Carla was found. The caller's speech was described as slurred, like he'd been drinking. "I didn't mean to kill her. I just wanted to fuck her," the man on the line proclaimed. Instead of transferring the call, the officer who answered simply took the man's name and phone number so that a detective could call him back. Needless to say, no information was ever obtained. There is another potential witness to the man who abducted and killed Carla. This woman also wished to remain anonymous, another testament to the fear that still lingers beneath the surface of so many friends and fellow students of Carla's. In fact, almost all of them remember the terrifying and harrowing events like they happened last week.
Okay, it was about 3 weeks after Carla had died. I used to walk around the block in our neighborhood, and I would take all the little neighborhood kids with me. So I probably had about 5 or 6 of them with me, and they were little. And I'm walking down the block, and about halfway down my block, this car pulls up. I remember it being kind of like a Buick. It reminded me of a boat. I mean, that's what I called it, was a big boat. And this guy said, "Hi, my name's so-and-so," which I cannot remember his name, but he said, "I just moved to the neighborhood, and I'm wanting to get to know a lot of the kids around here. I see there's a lot of kids around here because I'm going to be going to Western Hills." And I said, "Oh, okay." And I felt safe because I had the little kids with me, and it was broad daylight. And that's probably during spring break, I'm sure. I said, "Okay." He said, "Well, I'm going to go park my car at my house." And I didn't think too much about it. Well, he was right there. I mean, it was like I hadn't even gotten down to the other end of the block to turn the corner, and he was right there. So now that I'm thinking about it, he just parked his car somewhere, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, we were walking around the corner, and we were just talking, and I had the kids, and we're just, you know, walking around and talking, and we're just like a normal conversation. Nothing out of the ordinary, just how the weather was and how I thought about Western Hills and, you know. And I got closer to the house. Well, he came, you know, up to the house, and I introduced him to my mom and dad. So we had a pool table, so I said, "Do you want to play a game pool?" And he said, "Sure." So we played pool for I don't know how long. And like I said, it was broad daylight when we were walking. And then it started getting a little bit later, and the sun was going down, so it wasn't real dark yet, and we're sitting out on the curb at my house, and we're just talking, and then all of a sudden, out of the clear blue sky, he goes, "Sure, it's a nice night for a murder, just like Carla Walker." I was devastated, and I said, "What?" I said, "That's not even funny." I said, "I went to high school with her. I knew her." And I said, "That's not even funny at all." And I ran in the house, and I told Mom and Dad about it, because I said, you know, that just, it scared me. And right before that, he'd asked if I could take him home, and my mom said no. But when this happened, I ran back in the house, and I said, "He just said it was a nice night for a murder like Carla Walker." Of course, my dad and my mom just, you know, they kind of froze there, and they looked at me, and I just started bawling, and Daddy said, "I'll take him home." And Mother and our next-door neighbors, he was a police officer, so Mother called or went next door and said, "Hey, this is what just happened, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "You need to call this number." And so it was Lieutenant Ball. Mom said she remembers it, Lieutenant Ball. And Mother told him, "I want something done," because, you know, Carla had just passed away. And he said, "Okay." It was probably a couple, 3 days later, I guess. They called Mom back and said they had picked up this kid, and they had taken him down to the police station, and they were interrogating him or however they do it, and they were asking him some questions, and then he just stopped talking. And they said that, you know, that he didn't have any more information, they couldn't get any more out of him, and they let him go. I mean, who says that out of the clear blue sky when you're sitting there just talking about nothing? For a 17-year-old, that is very devastating, especially when she had just passed away. I have thought all these years that this is, he had something to do with it, or he knew something about it. All I remember is that he had short hair, sandy, blondish, brownish hair. My mother, I was talking to her the other day, and she said she remembers exactly what he wore. I said, "What was that?" And she goes, "He had blue jeans on, he had a green jacket." She said it was a vest. So I was figured it was probably the 70s, you know. She just said she remembers being a green vest, jacket type thing, and a light-colored shirt on. But we also found out, because he told me he was going to Hills, so that would have made him 16, 17 years old, maybe. He was 23, we found out. He was not high school age.
Thank you.
If you have any information about the abduction and murder of Carla Walker, please contact the Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, The Investigation and Evidence, Part 2, The Autopsy Report. We'd like to thank former Tarrant County Chief Deputy Jim Minter, former Benbrook Police Officer Dee Underwood, and our anonymous guests for their contributions to this episode. We'd also like to extend a special thanks to Brenda Wells for helping us fill in the timeline. As always, a huge thank you goes out to the Walker family for their continued support. You can subscribe and download Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. We can be contacted on Twitter or Facebook by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group. Please join us there. If you would like to support the show, please subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes. Your reviews help spread the word about the show, which of course brings more awareness to Carla's case. You can also share the show with a friend or stop by our Patreon page and make a small donation. We'd like to recommend thetruecrimefiles.com, a true crime blog that presents unsolved cases from just about everywhere. Each case is well presented, respectful, and full of thought-provoking insight. Please stick around to listen to a podcast preview from a good friend of Gone Cold. Thanks for listening, y'all.
When you think of the Ohio Valley, you may not associate it with evil, but unfortunately, evil is something that no place is safe from. From the crimes that made national headlines to the ones that people seem to have forgotten, every victim deserves to be remembered. Join me as we go through the cases of the Ohio Valley. You can find the Ohio Valley True Crime Podcast on Stitcher, iTunes, and most podcast services.